First, mixed marriages. We're going to talk about if there's an unbelieving spouse. Generally, if there's an unbelieving spouse, it's usually the husband who's the unbeliever. And that is such a prevalent problem that there's a whole section in the Bible devoted to talking about that, 1 Peter chapter 3. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it because it's a very easy passage to interpret, frankly. All you have to do is read it. It's painfully easy to interpret if you're in that kind of a position. 1 Peter 3:1, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. It's just not very hard to interpret. What should you do if your husband is an unbeliever? Win him without words. Just devote yourself to... That's what I meant about painfully easy to interpret. Just devote yourself to a pure, reverent life and be submissive and respectful. That's the goal of a woman who's married to an unbeliever, unbelieving husband, or a man who's married to an unbelieving wife. It's a little different for a man, but the idea is you attract him into the kingdom with your beauty is the whole point, really, that Peter is making. He goes on to talk about beauty, physical beauty. Verse 3, your beauty should not come from outward adornments, such as braided hair or the wearing of gold jewelry or fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who used to put their hope in God, used to make themselves beautiful. Then he goes on to talk about one of the most beautiful women ever. They were submissive to their husbands, their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. And that last statement is significant because it's a scary thing to do. To stop using your mouth and to just try and win him over by your life is a very scary... To just submit to him, submit to his leadership when he's not even a believer and doesn't even care about the Lord... is a very scary prospect. And so he says, you're Sarah's daughters, if you do what is right, do not give way to fear. Don't be afraid. God will still take care of you. He'll still guide you through life, even through an unbelieving husband. Now, you can't know for sure what's in a person's heart, whether or not a person for sure is a believer. Only God can perfectly judge whether or not someone is saved. So to the degree that your husband acts like an unbeliever, this principle applies. You should try and win him without words, by the purity of your life. I think this applies to someone who, even if your husband is likely a believer, but is behaving as an unbeliever in some way. So a guy who is just not godly in some aspect, I think the 1 Peter 3 principle applies. You approach that through quiet, submissive, pure, reverent life. Show him respect. And if you want a lot of detail on what does that mean and how exactly to do that and all the details on that, you can go through that whole marriage series that we did in Colossians 3. I highly recommend you listen through that. Understand the basic principles of marriage in Scripture is essential. And the whole thing about, especially if you have a tough time understanding about submission, which so many people do, what exactly does that mean? What is the difference between submission and subservience? It's a huge difference, and you need to understand all that. So I strongly recommend you listen to those.
You always do the respectful, but it's not like Sarah, master, is it? Because then aren't you putting him above God?
Master is the question is, if you got an unbelieving husband, you call him master, aren't you putting him above God? Isn't that putting him in too high of a position? What you have to understand is the point that Peter's making there is not so much of looking to your husband as some authority higher even than God. Rather, it's a term of respect. You speak of him with respectful terminology. Equivalent to this in our day would be sir. If a wife said to her husband, yes, sir, if he said something, she said, yes, sir, that would be an expression of enormous respect. Does anybody know CPR? Heimlich maneuver? Kay just passed out.
Jim said I couldn't say anything.
Yeah, and evidently you didn't say yes, sir. Okay. Sorry. Got to ease into these things. Sorry to just throw it out there as a shock like that.
A sweetheart will do, right?
A sweetheart isn't quite the same, but... The idea is to speak in respectful terms, to show him that you're impressed with him and you honor him and all that. And that's what has an effect on a man. A man craves that like a woman craves affection and love. So that's what God calls for. And the thing about without words, in Ephesians 5, we see the man is to win his wife with words. And that's just, that addresses us at our point of weakness and at our point of need, right? It addresses us both at our point of weakness. Very often, husbands will have the complaint, oh, my wife is nagging me, she's always badgering me or whatever. And so that's a weakness that Peter addresses, says, win him without words. And very often, wives complain about their husbands. He never talks to me. He never shares anything with me. He never opens up to me. He never is, you know. And so in Ephesians 5, he says, purify her with words, by means of words, literally. So that addresses us at our point of weakness and also at our point of need. Because women need to be talked to. They like to hear words. They want their husband to take an interest and to have discussion with them, pay attention to them. And so they have that need. Men have a need for honor and respect and are not as responsive to words. And some of you wives may have noticed that. So that's kind of the point there. So you try and win him over with the purity of your life. The question always comes up, what about an extreme situation? For example, how do you counsel abuse victims? First of all, that's very difficult because every married person is an abuse victim. Anyone who lives in the same house with a sinner is an abuse victim, no question about it. And all the principles that we've learned about suffering still apply to that. In the case where a woman is in danger of death or serious injury, I think it's appropriate for her to leave. And that's a personal opinion. There's no Bible passage that says that. But I do believe it's consistent with biblical principles because in the Old Testament, God calls his people to submit to the king. The king is the ultimate authority. And yet, when Saul, the king, was trying to kill David, it was appropriate for David to flee and to run and to deceive Saul and to deceive the high priest and eat the bread that was forbidden for anybody to eat. And Jesus in Matthew 12 seems to sanction what David did when he did all that. So if your life is at stake, when life and limb are at a significant risk, I think it's appropriate to flee. It's not appropriate to take revenge. It's not appropriate to show disrespect, but it is appropriate to flee. Even David wouldn't show disrespect to Saul even while he was fleeing. And when I say leave, understand this, I'm talking about divorce. And you may disagree with me on that, and if you do, then you may want to listen. I'm not going to give a whole defense for that. You need to listen through the tapes on divorce in that marriage series as well. But the Bible never sanctions leaving without divorce. You do not separate as a husband and wife without giving the other one a divorce so that they can at least remarry, because it just opens you up to temptation. Separating is not a biblical option unless it's for a short time, it's by mutual agreement, and it's for the purpose of prayer. Next is Christian marriage. Okay, Christian marriage. Both partners are believers. As I said upstairs, tips on how to get along, which comprise 100% of most marriage counseling, are just the last 5% of good marriage counseling. In most cases, if you begin with tips on how to get along, you are going to make the problem much worse than it already is, and I'll explain how. If you have a man who works too many hours at work, and he never listens to his wife, and the wife is miserable, and your first reaction when you hear that, those complaints, is you're going to want to solve the problem by getting the husband to do what? Come home earlier from work and start listening to his wife and pay more attention to her. I guarantee that's not going to work. That approach will not work. It never does. If a couple is fighting, the solution is not tips on communication skills or how to avoid bugging each other or all that. James 4:1 tells us why people fight. And that gets to the heart of the solution. James 4:1, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You're constantly mad at your spouse. It's not because of your spouse's failures. Everybody has a spouse that fails. If you're constantly mad at your spouse, it's because of you. It's because of something about you. The reason you quarrel and fight is because of your lusts, according to James 4. Your desires, strong desires that you're focused on getting satisfied no matter what. Now, I'm not talking here about sexual desire. When I say lusts, I don't mean sexual desire, although that could be one. I'm talking about the desires that you have to be treated in the way that you want to be treated. Your desire for a certain kind of treatment turns into a lust. Anytime a desire is elevated to the point where you must have it in order to be content, it's become a lust. And those lusts, the lust for respect, the lust for affection, the lust for kind words, the lust for consideration, those lusts rage inside you, go unfulfilled, and no matter how hard you try to control your anger, that anger will also always be coming out and directed toward the one who is blocking the fulfillment of your lust, those desires. And that's what James says is the cause of quarrels and fights. And look at the solution James gives. He doesn't give tips on how to get the lust satisfied. That's not the point. That's what most marriage counseling is. You have this strong desire to be treated a certain way. You have a lust to be treated a certain way. Here's how you can get that treatment that you're looking for. No, that's not the solution. It's not the solution to lust. The solution is not manipulating people to fulfill your lust. The solution is humility. What causes fights and quarrels? Don't you know they come from the desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. You kill and covet. You can't have what you want, and you quarrel and fight. You don't have because you don't ask God. And when you do ask, you don't receive because you ask with the wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your lusts, your pleasures. You adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Or do you think Scripture says without reason that the spirit he caused to live in us tends towards envy, and he gives us more grace? That's why Scripture says God opposes the proud, gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. The solution is humility and selflessness, dying to self. Typically, when somebody comes for marriage counseling, it'll be usually the woman who is so miserable she can't stand it another day, and so she comes for marriage counseling, or a man whose wife is so miserable that she's persuaded him to come seek marriage counseling. And that's just typical. It's not always the case. But men also become very miserable in a bad marriage, but they usually don't come for counseling. If it's just a man who's miserable, he's reluctant to seek counsel very often. But whoever it is, whoever's the driving force behind the seeking the counseling, generally, that person who's wanting the counseling has some objective in mind, right? They're seeking it for a reason. Your first step in marriage counseling is find out what that objective is. Who's driving this and what do they want? What do they want to accomplish? 9 times out of 10 it's this: I'm seeking counseling because my spouse is making my life intolerable and I want you to help me change my spouse. I want somebody else to help. Now, people rarely come right out and say that, but generally that's the unspoken goal. People who seek marriage counseling are very often angry and frustrated because their goal has been to get their spouse to change, and that goal has been blocked by guess who? Their spouse. And so they're angrier and angrier at their spouse all the time. I'm pretty sure pretty much every woman that I've counseled in marriage counseling has told me the same thing, and that's this: he keeps on saying that he's going to do this and he's going to do that, but nothing ever changes. Any of you ladies can relate to that? He keeps saying that nothing ever changes. Multiply thousands of Christian people who are dissatisfied with their spouse who would all agree to that statement. What's happening in that scenario? Do you suppose that the sanctification process that God has promised is short-circuited in that case? God has promised every believer is going to be sanctified. Day by day, we're being transformed in the image of Christ, according to 2 Corinthians 3:18. And that process, do you suppose, in that case of those marriages, that process is malfunctioned in a huge percentage of Christian marriages? Is it really true that those men aren't changing for the better, despite the promises of Scripture to the contrary? No. If the person is a Christian, he is being transformed into the likeness of Christ day by day. The problem is, if you tie your happiness to a person and put your hope in a person, a sinful person, it won't matter how much he changes or how much she changes. As long as he's a sinner, you will never be happy. God changes his children into his likeness, but almost never in the way or at the rate that you want him to do it and that you think best. And anytime you're living for a desire, any desire other than the desire for God, your life is going to be filled with anger and resentment at whoever stands in the way of the fulfillment of that desire.
What if you're a very good friend to a couple that they're not? What do you offer?
I think the question is, what do you do if they're both unbelievers and their marriage is falling apart? I hate to say this, but It's the same answer as all the other kind of counseling. You can't counsel people. The only counsel that you have for unbelievers is they need to be saved. There's no hope for them. You could help them patch up their marriage, give them tips on how to get along. It might make their path to hell a little smoother. But what good have you done, really? That's not what they need. What they need isn't more comfort. You know, what they need is the Lord. They need to be saved, and that's all your counseling. When you come to them, you say, "Okay, you're struggling in your marriage. I'd love to help you. Let's see what we can talk about." And he does this, and he does this, and she does this, and she does. Oh, I know just what you need. You need to be transformed. You need to have somebody who promises you something greater than the thing that will actually fulfill these longings that you have, that you're looking for to be fulfilled in your spouse. You need the Lord, and that's just. Everything's got to go back to that.
That's it. Yeah,
okay. Well, yeah, that's what I meant. Okay. So that's all evangelism for that. The reason James calls that kind of life adulterous is because the one legitimate desire that should drive everything in our lives is our desire for God. And so if you're living for some other desire, that's adultery. When I'm not satisfied with Him, with God, and I can find satisfaction only in some earthly thing or earthly relationship, I'm committing adultery against God. And when somebody is dissatisfied with his or her marriage, generally there are four virtues that he needs to learn. You ready for this? Somebody has a problem in marriage, you need to teach them four things. Number one, contentment. Number two, forgiveness. Number three, humility. Number four, love. Now, the person who's seeking the counseling, who is unhappy, you need to teach them these things. That is very difficult because they're focused on their spouse changing. You can't change their spouse. If their spouse isn't seeking counseling from you, you don't have the ability to go and change their spouse. So you got to address them.
Number one?
I'll get to those. I'll get to those four. Don't worry about it. I'll go over those. But let me just say, I'm just trying to say that you need to address the spouse. And this is a very difficult thing to change their thinking because they're not thinking about them changing. They're thinking about the spouse changing. And as long as that's the case, you can get nowhere. Now, it could be that they're not interested in changing. And they're not interested in your counsel on how they can change. You need to find that out. That's why I said at the very beginning, what is the objective? What are you looking for? You want me to change your spouse? Sorry, can't help. You want me to help you grow spiritually? I can have some things to offer. Not interested in that? It could be they're not interested. It could be that they're just coming to you. They just want somebody to understand. They just want somebody else to know what they're going through. And they want someone to feel for them and to offer them comfort. And if that's the case, then you can just do that. Don't even give them marriage counseling. Just give them comfort and say, just help them understand how to go through trials and how to handle suffering and all that we've talked about so much. Encourage them to develop strong friendships in the church and fellowship and all that. Okay, but if they're open to be counseled themselves, then these are the four things they need. And we'll go through each of them. But I wanted to make a big point of that because it's so hard to get people's thinking shifted over. And they think it already is shifted over, but they usually isn't. Because after a while, living for your lust, it really, really seems like the fulfillment of those lusts is the only way to happiness. It just seems so much like that. And the longer you've lived that way, the more seemingly impossible it will be to believe that happiness and contentment could come without you getting this thing that you desire. I have a woman who comes to me and she says, this is what my life is like. And she describes what sounds to me like hell. She describes an existence with her husband that he is treating her so bad and her situation is so horrible. And then I need to try and convince her that you can have fulfillment and joy and a fulfilled marriage and happiness in the midst of that circumstance without him changing at all. That is so impossible for a person to believe who has lived for years and years and years thinking the only path to happiness is to get my desire fulfilled. And I'm talking legitimate desires. It's a legitimate desire to want your spouse to treat you the right. It's a legitimate desire to want a good, strong, healthy marriage. It's a legitimate desire for a woman to want a man who's a spiritual leader. All those things are legitimate desires. They only cross over into spiritual adultery when you have to have those in order to be content. So it's not uncommon for you to sit there and tell them everything that I just said and have them nod their head, absolutely, I understand, I agree, totally, yes. And then 5 minutes later, they're talking about how poorly they're treated again. And they're right back onto that. And they're saying they can't be happy while they're being treated that way. And you can tell they haven't adjusted their goals at all. You have to adjust your, you have to get them to adjust their goal and make, set a goal that's 100% within their power to achieve. Most of us have goals in our marriage that are not totally in our power. Your spouse has to cooperate in order for you to reach your goal, and then the spouse doesn't cooperate, and what does that cause? More anger towards your spouse. You set your goals that you can reach yourself. But it's hard to do because people are so well-trained in Christianese and all the lingo that this stuff doesn't even faze them because they're just used to hearing it. You know, don't be self-centered and all that. Very often what you have to do is end up starting the whole thing out by rebuking them. So you're getting an idea here why I'm such a popular marriage counselor here, right? I don't get a lot of return customers, but... Each time they begin saying something that indicates that they're living for the goal of being treated better, interrupt them and say, that's exactly the kind of thing that it can do nothing but produce more anger and more misery in your life. And they have to drill that into them. Sometimes you have to jar their thinking past the Christianese in order to get them to come to grips with changing their goals and not make it the pursuit of their desires. Your goals have to be something that can't be blocked. Some people will give up the pursuit of their desires only if they're convinced that you'll pick up where they left off in pursuing their desire. I'll stop nagging my husband if you'll start, is basically the idea. When a person is living for lusts, you can give him or her all the tips in the world about communication and getting along, and there will be constant quarrels and fights. And when, remember when I told you it's going to make matters worse? The reason it makes matters worse, when you give tips on how to get along, is because you just feed this thought that, oh, I'll be happy if he just treats me better and I treat her better and, you know, what him better, whatever. We treat each other better, we get along, and we do these things, then happiness will come. That's the whole error in their thinking, and you're just feeding that by saying, oh, why don't you try, you know, pick up your socks more often and don't slam the door or whatever and all those kinds of things. All better communication skills will do is make the person more skilled at manipulating his or her spouse to get his desires fulfilled. All right, so here's the four virtues you need to teach the person who's open to counsel. No matter what your spouse is like, no matter what you have in common, don't have in common, no matter what your past is like, no matter what your marriage was like, no matter what your last marriage was like, no matter what, if you progress in these four things, you can have a healthy marriage. And we've talked at length about these in other studies, and so I'm just going to briefly talk about how they relate to marriage. Number one is contentment. The things your spouse does that bother you are just another aspect of the whole package of suffering that God has for you in this life. That's why it's happening to you, is because it's God's package of suffering. The last time your spouse did something you really didn't like, ask yourself this. Why didn't you divorce? Why didn't you? I recently asked a woman that. She said, my husband's doing terrible things to me. I said, why didn't you divorce him? She said, because of my commitment to Christ. It would be wrong. And that's a good answer. Well, if that's the answer, then your suffering in your marriage is due to your commitment to Christ, right? Or for your commitment to Christ, you can just leave. So if you're suffering in your marriage, that suffering is due to your commitment in Christ. Therefore, it's in the category of suffering for Christ, bearing in your body the marks of Christ. The exact same thing Paul said when he says, I'm suffering for Christ. I bear the marks of Christ. The whippings that he took were for Christ. You can say the same thing. If you're suffering in your marriage, you're suffering for Christ because it's because of your commitment to Christ that you're going through that suffering. That's a noble thing. The person needs to understand that in this life, suffering is the name of the game, and you have your choice. Suffering of singleness or suffering of marriage. But suffering is it in this life. I don't mean to say that marriage is a bad thing and that's only suffering. But in a fallen world, we all know you cannot have a love relationship that doesn't involve suffering. The more you love, the more you're going to suffer. And when we're not content to say to God, look, God, the level of suffering that you have ordained for me in my life, when we say it's not tolerable, this level of suffering you give me is unacceptable. As Christians, we are trying to rebuke God then. We're second-guessing God. We have to be willing to accept the suffering that we receive at the hand of God, no matter what it is. And however much it is, that's the amount He's chosen. And one thing that'll help is to see it as that. Don't think of it as it coming from your spouse and your spouse being the source. He's just a secondary cause. God is the source of your suffering. It's very important to realize. So you can take the attention off of being mad at your sinful spouse, and you can turn your attention to being thankful for disciplining Heavenly Father. He's the one in charge of suffering. So, as we found 2 weeks ago, endure hardship as discipline. That applies to suffering in marriage. Some people can handle all kinds of suffering in the rest of their life, but for some reason they have the idea that there's not supposed to be suffering in their marriage. And so they may do great at handling every other kind of suffering. You know, they can get a disease and they can handle that, and they can get all kinds of things. But they can't apply those same good godly attitudes towards the suffering in their marriage because they don't think of it in the category of suffering for Christ. So the first step in marriage counseling is bring whoever you're counseling to the point of saying, Lord, I don't want anything other than what you have for me. That's contentment. I don't want anything other than what you want for me. It's very, very hard. Because when somebody comes to you, a woman comes to you and she's being a wonderful wife and her husband is being a terrible husband, your natural inclination is to focus your attention on the husband, right? But all that's going to do is it's going to do her more harm. It's going to further her thinking that that's what her solution is. When you talk to her about that and commiserate with her, all you're doing is pushing her to the opposite direction that she needs to go. And you make her less and less content. And if you make your counselee less and less content, you've done more harm than good. It'd been better if they hadn't come to you. Your goal is to make them more and more content. It feels unreasonable to address the spiritual problem of lack of contentment when she's trying so hard to be a good wife and her husband is being such a crumb. And he's being so cruel and she's being so wonderful, and then you're rebuking her for not having contentment. It just seems ridiculous. And it'll feel like you don't have the right to do that. And you have to understand that you don't have the right to do it, but God does. God has the right to say, look, this is the amount of suffering that I have ordained for you, and I expect you to be content, find contentment, and live in a content way. God has the right to do that. You're God's spokesman, and as a counselor, that's what you are. You're a Bible teacher. And so you have the authority to say this. It's the greatest gift you can give her anyway. It's the only path to happiness for her. Teach her to pray, Lord, you've given me the same thing you've given every other married woman, a man who hurts me. That's what every married woman has. A man who hurts her. Obviously, it's my request. You can teach her to pray. It's my request that he do so less and less, but whatever your will and timing is on that, I willingly accept from your hand. That's what you need to teach her to pray. Okay, so teach contentment. Number two, teach forgiveness. After years of living for desires and then having those desires frustrated by their spouse, a person builds up resentment. A lot of resentment. Mountains of resentment in many cases. And sometimes they don't even realize it. But when you resent someone, there's nothing that person can do to make you happy. There's no way. No matter how much he changes. When a woman gets to the point of resenting her husband, he might make all kinds of changes, but she'll never be satisfied by them. And here's why. And we'll use the illustration that I mentioned before. Suppose a man works too much. And he messes up the house all the time. And creates a lot of work for his wife. And the wife builds up resentment over that, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and finally she blows up at him, and they get a big fight. And so he says, okay, I'm going to change, and I'm going to really try and change. And he makes some definite, real changes at work. He actually makes some changes that he thinks are going to make a significant difference. And the result isn't quite as big a difference as he hoped. Now he's coming home late 12 nights a month instead of 20. You think she's going to notice that? With all this resentment built up? No, a wife who resents her husband is going to be so focused on those 12 nights that he's still coming home late, she's not going to be able to see any change. Every one of those 12 nights, every minute that he's late, she's building up anger, thinking nothing ever changes. Denying what Scripture says. Even after a wonderful day of sanctification, your spouse is going to be almost as sinful as he was yesterday. You got that? Even after a huge day of sanctification, he's still going to be almost as sinful as he was yesterday. Growth is slow. And that's true for every day of the rest of your life. After a great day of growth, Josiah is almost the same size as he was yesterday. To his dismay sometimes. Eventually he'll grow up, but it's just slow. When you respect someone, the issue isn't how godly your spouse is. The issue is how forgiving you are. This side of heaven. And when you respect someone, you tend to cut that person slack and you don't see his faults. You see a beautiful, wonderful marriage in the church, and you think, oh, only if my husband could only be like that. You know what? That guy is a sinful man who hurts his wife. The reason they have a great marriage is because his wife's a great forgiver. When you resent someone, and I know that from experience, when you resent someone, you tend to notice everything they do wrong. When you respect someone, you cut them slack. You see the things they're doing right. But when you resent someone, you notice every failure, and you're blind to anything that's good. And the solution is to spend enough time thinking about how much God has forgiven you so that you'll have the ability to forgive him unconditionally and unilaterally and immediately.
Someone,
oh, if you cut them slack. Yeah, well, yeah, that's, you know, how do you get to the point of...
Come first, right. Respect comes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, respect is something that you... There's a number of things, steps that you can work towards building. Learning how to show respect, how to respect someone is a process. Forgiving them is a good step in that. There's a few others, and they're in that marriage series. And it's the same thing with your wife. Learning how to delight in your wife is a process that takes effort and energy and work. So those aren't just a decision. Oh, I think I'll just do it. It takes the work. But unilateral, instant, unconditional forgiveness is essential. And it has to be an ongoing thing. You overlook faults and sins as quickly as you notice them. Vitally important that you never get into a pattern of having a building, rising anger. Your spouse does something, makes you mad. Then he does something else, and you're a little bit more mad, and it just kind of builds and builds. It doesn't matter how slowly it's building. If it's building, eventually it's going to get big, right? I mean, it might take 2 weeks, it might take 25 years, but somehow it's going to keep, if it's building, it's going to get too big eventually. So you can't live in a way where things build. Some couples do that. Build, 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 blow up. Build, 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 blow up, you know, and that's just their whole life. Each thing that bothers you needs to be finally dealt with as it happens in your heart. Because if things are piling up, it doesn't matter how small they are, how infrequent they are, especially eventually the pile is going to get huge and you're going to explode and your spouse will be helpless to do anything about it. And that's the bad thing. Your spouse will be absolutely helpless. I mean, think about it. What can I do about a pile of 500 sins that I've committed against Tracy? She's got 500 grievances against me. What can I do about that from the past? I can apologize and repent over this last one, but you're not going to be satisfied with that because you got this other 499. I can talk to you and try and discover another 200 complaints that you have against me, but that still leaves 300. When you allow things to build up, you're putting your spouse in a hole that there's absolutely no way out. So teach forgiveness. Number three, teach humility. Forgiveness requires selflessness and humility. You have to die to yourself to do all this because it means getting hurt for the rest of your life. And that's something to let your counselor know too. I have a plan for you that involves being hurt the rest of your life. It means, for one thing, giving up your fight for your rights, and it requires placing your spouse's interests ahead of your own and living that way. Gotta teach them humility. And then fourth, love. Teach them love. I said before, your goal should be something that's totally in your control and can't be blocked. Your goal should be to love your spouse. If you love your spouse from your side, your marriage is a success. So work as hard as you can at taking delight in your spouse. And husbands, that doesn't mean just providing an income and doing work around the house and purchasing all the requisite flowers and cards. It means actually taking delight in her and taking satisfaction in her. And wives, it doesn't mean just doing housework and providing physical intimacy and doing whatever you do. It means truly taking delight in your husband and looking up to him with real, genuine respect and honor. So work towards that. And I realize I'm just breezing over. These are huge topics, every one of them. And it's a major, major goal for you to go through Scripture and try and flesh out how to do this. But I'm just saying these are the major, four major things. People need to be brought to a point of contentment, forgiveness, humility, and love. And they'll have a wonderfully strong marriage from their end. Now, let me just say something about premarital counseling, because you probably have an occasion to do that too. And I'm not talking about formal situations. I'm just talking about you know somebody, and the next thing you know, they met someone, and now they're engaged, and you're on a drive with them, talking to them about, you know, the fact that they're about to get married, and so you're giving them some counsel. Premarital counseling is the least helpful kind of counseling. You got two options. You can either talk to them about whether or not it's wise for them to get married, which they don't have ears to hear that. They've already made they're engaged. They're not going to listen to that. Or you can give them tips on how to get along, which they don't have any context to even apply the principles. You can say, when he does this, when she does this, they're not going to remember that. They haven't lived together. They don't even know what you're talking about. So they're not going to remember those things. It'll be quickly forgotten. Much better is pre-engagement counseling and post-marital counseling. You do pre-engagement counseling to help the couple decide whether or not to get engaged, and then you do post-marital counseling after they've been married 6 months to give them tips on how to get along. Then they'll have ears to hear it. And for pre-engagement counseling, it's really easy. Really easy. Just make sure they're both really strong believers and that the man is a spiritual leader. You say, what does that mean? It means she does better spiritually when she's around him than she does without him. Now that's going to cancel a huge percentage of potential engagements in the Christian world, which would be good. Then you don't have to do so much marriage counseling. With these women who live for as a spiritual leader in their home for 2 or 3 years and then finally just become exhausted because God didn't design them to be the spiritual leader in the home. And they get worn out, and they should have married a spiritual leader. Debbie?
How does Matthew 18 fit into marriage counseling?
The reason it's very hard is because most of the sins that we have complaints with each other over aren't really church discipline issues. Because the person is either repentant or it's an attitude that can't really be discerned for sure by someone who's not living there in the home. So if a woman comes and says, my husband gets drunk every night, just goes out partying and gets plastered and, you know, he's sleeping around and all that stuff. Well, then that's easy. She's confronted him. Now me and her both confront him and then on we go with the church discipline process. But if it's, thing where so she comes and says, you know, he's angry all the time, and I confront him on that, and he says, yeah, I do have a problem with anger. I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to work on that. Well, he's got a repentant attitude. That's the end of the church discipline process. Much to the wife's dismay sometimes because she's going to want more pressure on him. If it's some ongoing thing that he's not repentant of, but it's hard to, you know, if a man says, my wife is sinning because she's not content, well, then I can't just go and observe her and say, oh, sure enough, she's not content. Okay, you know, church discipline, you're out. That's something that's, we can't judge a person's heart in that way. It could be that he's right, but those aren't the kinds of things we pursue with church discipline. So that's kind of hard. It's kind of hard. But yeah, they should have confronted each other before they, if that's what they're trying to do, is if it's a church discipline thing.
Matthew 18 addresses any kind of offense.
Right. If they're coming because they want to address a sin in the spouse's life, then yeah, it's a church discipline issue. But if they're coming for marriage counseling, they should be coming for how can I be a better husband, how can I be a better wife, that kind of thing. And then you don't even have to talk about the spouse.
In that sense, aren't we talking as brothers and sisters rather than elders in the church?
Yeah, and really, you just, you know, if somebody comes to you as a friend and says, well, you know, I got another friend of mine or spouse of mine or whatever is got this problem, how can I handle it? You know, and you're just giving advice. That's kind of what the category is. Anyway, premarital counseling, pre-engagement counseling, you just find out if the man's a spiritual leader, if they're both strong believers, and if they're both strong in those four virtues. And then you just tell them, look, the stronger you are in these four virtues, the better your marriage will be. And if you're doing well in these four virtues and the guy's a spiritual leader, then get married. None of that other stuff about compatibility is important. I don't care if they have things in common or if they like the same sports or, you know, all that stuff. None of that's in the Bible. That doesn't matter. You can learn to find things to do.
What about cases where you have someone who is what I would call maybe a lukewarm believer, you know?
Yeah, that's all I do. That's all I do. When people come to me and they want premarital counseling and I discern that they're probably not saved, I just give them the gospel, and then I say I don't see real strong evidence of a passionate commitment to Christ, which is essential for a godly marriage. So I don't see any purpose of marriage. And so I don't, as a pastor, I don't marry people like that. And I think the only real counsel I give them is to get serious about their walk with the Lord and postpone getting married. Because, you know, I say, look, if one of you gets serious about the Lord and the other one doesn't, you're going to be miserable.
You're not drifting at all.
Yeah, question is, what about people who aren't even believers and they have a great marriage? And I think the answer is same thing with any Christian virtue. There's the Lord in His mercy and grace restrains sin in a lot of ways. And it's, there's this image of God that got shattered at the fall, but it's still present in every single human being that's alive. And to the degree that that image of God is there, people can exhibit godliness. And I think it's through godly traits. If you look at marriages like that, even though they're unbelievers, you look at what's strong about their marriage, and it's godly traits. It's things Scripture calls us to. It's selflessness, it's forgiveness, it's humility and contentment. Okay, now, just real quick, I'm going to give you some tips on how to get along. We've done 95% of the marriage counseling. Now we get to the tips on how to get along. There are some marital counselors. I mean, there's just a couple weeks ago, I was doing some marital counseling with a couple, and they were already fine on all the stuff we just covered. They understood all that already. And all they really needed was just, you know, one little tip on getting along, and it solved this little struggle they were having. And so when you get someone who, they understand these principles, then there are a few tips on getting along. Now, please, don't go to these tips on getting along until you've done all that, because that's all essential first. But here's my tips on getting along. First, actually just one thing. Do a planning retreat every 6 months. It's done wonders for Tracy and his marriage. And if you can't afford it, find a way to afford it. Take all the money that you'd otherwise spend on cards and gifts that you need to make up and put it towards one night's stay in a hotel with three or four meals out every 6 months or at least once a year. A lot of marriages never improve, not because they don't know what's wrong and not because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing, but because they never actually take any intentional approach to how to take steps to making the changes. They just complain about what's wrong. When the book of Proverbs teaches us about making our plans succeed, the implication is that it's wise to make plans. You know, when it says make plans by seeking advice and then they'll succeed, in Proverbs 20 or Proverbs 15, plans fail for lack of counsel, it's just assuming that plans are good and you should make plans. God requires us to be good stewards of our lives and to live wisely, and part of living wisely means making plans. Proverbs 21:5 says the plans of the diligent lead to profit. So, it's not wise to just fly through life or fly through your marriage by the seat of your pants making decisions on the fly. God has given you a life that is of immeasurable value and a marriage that is of great value. And our lives are in our control only as stewards. And so we need to be careful to make plans and not just have a disheveled life or a disheveled marriage. Proverbs 16:3, commit to the Lord whatever you do and your plans will succeed, means to be established and made firm. He blesses us by causing our plans to be realized. And amazingly, even God makes plans. So have a retreat once every 6 months for the purpose of planning. And here's how you do it, real quick. For each meal, go somewhere where you can sit for quite a while. Go to a restaurant where you can be there for a while and bring a notebook and a pen. And just begin listing all the weaknesses of the marriage. Everything you can think of. This is the only time in your marriage you're allowed to do this, okay? So enjoy it. But list out every weakness. Just write them all out. Just brainstorm. All the potential threats that you can think of to your marriage that might become a weakness. Now, the first two or three times you do this, it'll be mostly weaknesses, and after that it'll become mostly threats because the weaknesses will be addressed. But the threats are significant too. There are threats looming out there that could cause unhealthiness to come into your marriage, and you need to address those. Now, here's what you do. Meal number one in your retreat. We're cramming all this process into kind of a short time here if you just have one overnight stay. It's good if you can do two nights, but anyway, if you just do one, we'll do it this way. Don't get carried away with how many things you're going to try to address. Once you've written all the weaknesses down, pick maximum the top five that you both agree are the top five. You both go through and rate the list and decide what are the five biggest issues. And you can pick whatever number. You can do the top three, the top two, top six, but you don't get too carried away. Some issues can wait 6 months until the next retreat. Others need to be handled right away. So once there's a consensus on the top five, write those on a new piece of paper. So you got these issues you're going to work on. Now put the paper away and just enjoy each other and have fun until your next meal. Now, meal number two. The goal here is to take an organized approach to addressing the first five issues. We tend to go through life with an awareness of things that need attention, and we mumble things like, oh, I need to get organized, or my marriage needs attention, or I got to get our budget together, or I need to exercise, or I need to spend more time with the kids, or whatever. And they never get done because we never make specific goals. They're just generalities. The purpose of this session is to set specific goals. The more specific the goal, the better. And try to avoid vague words like improve, cut back, give more energy to, things like that. And by the way, this applies to singles too. It isn't just for marriage planning, but for your life planning. This is a good thing to do just for your life in general. Don't use vague terms. Don't say, I want to get in shape. That is a poor goal. Get in shape. A good goal is something that can be measured. I want to work out 20 minutes 5 days a week, or something like that. That you can measure. Instead of, I want to spend more time with the kids, say something like, my goal is to devote one full hour, beginning as soon as supper is over, to the kids 4 days a week, or something like that. A bad goal is, I need to be more romantic. A good goal is, if we haven't gone on a date by the last Friday of the month, every month, that Friday it is, that's going to be blocked off on our calendar, and we're going to do that every time. Specific, realistic goals. And once the goal, and make sure they're realistic, otherwise you just create more heartache. Once all the goals are written, put the paper away and enjoy each other until the next meal. All right, meal number 3. Plan the specific steps to reaching each goal. And this is a long one, so find a real comfortable restaurant for this one. If your goal is to have family devotions every night, you say, okay, that was one of my goals. We're going to have family devotions every morning or every night. How are you going to get to your life pattern right now to that? Who's going to plan it? Who's going to lead it? How are you going to find good materials to use? By what date will these materials be purchased? Who will be in charge of getting the family together and calling them all in? What are you going to do when the phone rings during devotions? Where will this take place? What about nights when you have guests come over? How are you going to do it then? If you have a goal of, okay, we're going to have a date once a month, a date night, who's going to plan this date? How are you going to make sure there's money available for this date? What has to take place on the date in order for the date to be successful? How is that going to be achieved? What kind of a standard is there for a good date? If the date is going to be on the last Friday of the month, what day will you plan what you're going to do? You know, and all the, I mean, all these kinds of things. If your goal, say you have a goal, I'm going to study the Bible 30 minutes a day. How are you going to do that? What are your steps? What will you study? What materials will you use? What about days that you oversleep? Then what? You know, all that. And it's okay to include personal goals in here, too, outside of the marriage. The action steps are very helpful in weeding out unrealistic goals. Because you get an unrealistic goal, and then you start doing action steps, and you start to realize in a hurry, oh, this isn't going to work. So that's good. And then the last step is to decide when you're going to go back over this list and check to see how you're doing. Is it going to be 1 week later, 2 weeks later? When are you going to review, get this piece of paper that you're writing on out? First of all, where are you going to put this piece of paper? And then when are you going to get it out and go over and say, okay, how are we doing? Tracy and I, the first week we did this, we did 2 weeks later, half of our goals got crossed off. That was ridiculous. That was unrealistic. What were we thinking on that? You know, it takes a few times before you get the hang of this. Because your first one, you're going to set your goals way too high, and you're going to have way too many. But the more minor the adjustment is to your lifestyle, the more chance of success. The fewer changes you make, the more chance you're going to have at success. And the value of this approach is it relieves so much anxiety and worry that if I pursue selflessness, I'm going to get stomped on. See, that's what you're afraid of, right? If I just concern myself with me and I don't bug my spouse to change, nothing will ever change. And this eliminates that because you can at least say, well, at least at our 6-month thing, he's going to ask me, okay, what can I do to be a better husband? It also eliminates the need to criticize each other in between planning retreats. You never have to do that. And if there's some problem you know that needs addressing, you can just save it for the next retreat and overlook it for now, which eliminates 99% of the nagging of each other, and you don't get to the problem of suppressed nagging turning to resentment because you have a confidence that it'll be addressed at the next planning retreat. And amazingly, by the time you get to the next planning retreat, 90% of those things fade from your memory anyway. So you can relax, and you don't have so many complaints about each other, and you realize they're insignificant anyway. And so instead of little things building into an impossible mountain of resentment, they just keep fading to nothingness and disappearing altogether. One other tip. Don't think of the planning retreat as a vacation. That'll ruin it, because then you're going to be seeking pleasure. You're going to think it, you're going to be looking to enjoy it, and then you'll be disappointed. Don't think of it as a time to enjoy. When you have a goal of enjoying yourself, that puts all kinds of pressure on the retreat, and it doesn't. And then if it didn't turn out to be fun enough, then you're upset. Think of it as work.